This is Matthew Putman, and you're listening to Utility Function. The global devastation caused by the COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted an urgent need for radical innovation in the healthcare industry. Reactive rather than preventative approaches to medicine must change if we want to keep people safe from life-threatening illness and highly contagious diseases. In devising solutions to these issues, it's essential that we look towards a new standard of medical care. Today, I discuss that standard with Andre Watson, the CEO and co-founder of Ligandol Inc., a personalized medicine company that is revolutionizing pandemic response strategies. Ligandol is currently working to develop solutions for cancers and rare diseases through precision genetic medicine. By making use of AI and bioinformatics, Ligandol's innovative delivery technologies are capable of stopping disease at its immediate source, the genes themselves. Andre and I get into his perspective on healthcare from the standpoint of a biological scientist, what excites us most about the radical evolution of nanomedicine, Andre's vision for the future of societal health, and the importance of creating preventative medical plans for each unique individual.
Yeah, I just want to chat it up with you a little bit. I think we haven't even known each other for that long, but I feel like we've been friends forever. Mm-hmm. It's one of those rare things that happens in life. So I feel great deal of gratitude for that, Andre. So thank you.
Yeah, we kept circling around for years. I remember meeting you at James Watson's thing many years ago.
Yeah. That was interesting. What do you think about that? What do you think about James Watson?
I thought it was raucous, man.
Was he a big influence on you early in your career or early in life?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, I have respect where it's due, for sure. I just think some of the stuff with Rosalind Franklin and some of the things that have otherwise been said are a little controversial.
I mean, it's interesting that you say that because I would think somebody that's working in your field, which we'll get into, you wonder if the field would exist at all if it wasn't for the work that that group did. How much does it matter that to the field, whether, you know, Watson himself treated people right or, you know, what happened in their personal life as opposed to the work they produce?
Yeah, I mean, that's always the argument. I think it still is an interesting topic, I suppose, the separation of the person from the thing they do. I feel like we do that sometimes. And sometimes we need technologies or things, but I think everyone should try to be decent.
Yeah. I mean, that's, yeah, I'm, we're lucky with you, Andre. You're decent and groundbreaking.
Thanks. Try to be decent at least.
But, you know, I was telling you earlier that, you know, I don't like this to be a lesson about science per se and more of a conversation. That said, I've spent, long career using the word nanotechnology, talking about personalized medicine, a lot of the same things that you're actually making a reality. Strangely enough, nanotechnology, some people have rolled their eyes when I say it. It's like it's some weird sci-fi thing that will never happen, or it's some politically charged thing, or it's some Silicon Valley notion. First of all, do you see that has changed at all recently?
Yeah, I still think a lot of people don't really know what nanotechnology means. And it's funny.
Can you tell us?
I mean, it's funny. So really, nanotechnology is, you know, a certain size of technology, just like a car is macro technology. But, you know, technically so is, I don't know, like a thermos or fridge. Just looking at objects in the room. I mean, like these, you know, if that is macro technology, then nanotechnology is small technology that is, you know, usually around 100 nanometers, but less than 1,000 nanometers if you're being technically correct, and as small as a few nanometers. You get into anything smaller, you're dealing with, you know, molecules basically. So, and anything larger, you're dealing with micro technology. So it's funny to me because every bit of electronics and, you know, every computer we use, decades of research had to happen, taking even something like transistors, which used to be, you know, giant tubes, and bringing that down to, you know, 30 nanometer processes, and then, you know, smaller, and then 15. And, you know, we're just getting smaller and smaller. But that has been, Moore's law has been driven in part by our ability to make faster or smaller nanotechnology in terms of circuits and stuff. And nanomedicine, though, right?
So sometimes I find that this definition, which seemed to come about when something called the Nanotechnology Initiative came about, where they kept, you know, changing the definition of nanotechnology from something I find incredibly exciting, you know, the work that Eric Drexler did, the work in, and now the, you know, the work in things that were either inspired by the way the body works or directly the body itself. So nanomedicine is, I guess, at that scale, is that right? The 100 nanometer or less scale?
Yeah.
Explain the rest of it to us. Why should we be excited about nanomedicine as opposed to just small things?
Yeah, I mean, nanomedicine excites me because it allows us to essentially package up and deliver different molecules to specific places in the body. And you can be quite broad in your definition of what nanomedicine means. So taking, you know, a classical example is taking maybe a chemotherapy and then sticking a drug targeting molecule on there so that it goes to a cancer. Then there's a lot with nanoparticles, which are a big part of nanomedicine, which is these packaging and delivery systems inside your body, which historically has been a lot of cancer applications, but now we're looking at more gene therapies. And, you know, it's funny, nanomedicine also is basically Moderna's, Pfizer's, all these vaccines that are delivering mRNA nanoparticles. That is nanomedicine. That was technology that was originally developed for gene therapy applications and then used for vaccine technology too. So that is one of the more broad examples that personally excites me the most, because we're looking at not just delivering a chemo drug to a cancer, but actually being able to do programmatic engineering of biology temporarily or permanently to alter and cure disease states. So
I think it's interesting that people still think that when we talk about nanotechnology or even nanomedicine, so nanotechnology, yes, you could say that maybe a semiconductor uses nanotechnology in the sense that we're looking at very small nanoscale features, but that nanomedicine is still something that is in the future. And now over the last 2 years, most of us have had nanotechnology injected into our body.
Yeah.
I find that, so, you know, a lot of it is convincing the world that it is already here. Where does it differ when you talk about something like a mass manufactured vaccine and moving to nanomedicine for personalized medicine?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing there is that the vaccine doses are very small. It's a very small amount of material. So we're dealing with, 100 micrograms or 50 micrograms. So, you know, 50 millionths or 100 millionths of a gram, very small amounts of material. And that works for vaccine technology because you only need a small amount of a little piece of a virus to appear in your muscle or your body to kind of say, well, what is that? And try to figure out what is going on. What is this new sequence you've inserted that doesn't belong in my body? That's one application where it works pretty well. But then we look at a lot of these rare diseases, and you need much larger doses to treat not just a rare disease, but if you're doing a gene therapy, you need much larger doses. Just for comparison, you know, when you go get, let's say, a Johnson & Johnson vaccine because it's a virus, that can, I don't know exactly how much it costs, but it's probably on the order of $20 or something, right? But then if you're getting a gene therapy for genetic disease, your manufacturing costs are in the hundreds of thousands or even approaching $1 million. And so we're dealing with a lot more material. So making sure that those larger doses are safe and effective and also go to the right place, or in the case of mRNA, that they can be repeatedly dosed, that is where we're looking at safety, toxicity, and efficacy issues that we don't see with the vaccine technologies. And I think personalized medicine, in the broader sense, if we work backwards from where we want to be, which is, in my opinion, that's one of the better places to start, because you can actually think about what we need and then figure out how to get there. You know, we need to unlock ways of targeting all the organs and specific cell types that are relevant for different disease states. In order to get there, we have to develop the targeting technologies and the safe and effective delivery systems that can work at various doses. And then once we have those platforms, and it will start with rare diseases and, you know, cancers and lethal indications, but once we have the proof points of delivery to the relevant tissues, you can then start to expand those platforms to encompass broader deliveries for even multi-gene things that might be required for more complex disease states, or reprogramming factors to push back the clock on older tissue. Things like this, which might be harder to do as your initial thing, but it's about having the platform for the delivery and the ability to deliver programmatic instructions to biology. Once you have that, once the FDA says, okay, great, these technologies exist in all of these contexts, perhaps for rare diseases first, then you can start to bring down the costs a lot and increase the distribution for all of these other applications. At some point, you know, I think personalized medicine starts with still with a lot of cancers, with a lot of rare diseases, even something like beta thalassemia, which is a rare genetic disease. There are more than 300 mutations that cause beta thalassemia. So you could go in there and say, all right, I'm just going to delete the whole gene and try to replace this giant thing, or I'm going to do a trick that only cuts DNA and people produce fetal hemoglobin. But if you're actually approaching this in a personalized way, you might do sequencing. And if the gene editing is sufficiently advanced, go in there and actually fix the specific mutations people have. And that's just an obvious use case that if you can do that, would you even define each of those mutations as the same disease? Or would you say that it's like a personalized approach? If you can do that, then you can also do so many other things, right? And that's really what excites me. And I think once we reach those critical thresholds of showing these platforms can be used for multiple things and quickly repurposed and still maintain their efficacy for, let's say, different disease states, then it's just hyper exponential in how quickly these technologies permeate the market.
Right. So it's really moving biology and, you know, nanomedicine is like the computer programming of our day, right? So, and this is obviously not the way the FDA currently thinks. This isn't the way that you do, you know, drug trials generally, but it's a matter of, you know, I guess I could picture it as, you know, I would be at home, I do a genome sequencing, I would maybe do a health test of some time, a blood test to see where I am in a healthy state, and then you would manufacture a nanomedicine. I know some of your technology, which we can talk about, that would be specific to me. But it's, you know, it's changing the program. It's not reinventing the wheel here. You will have already proven that for whatever disease I have, there is some type of, you know, some type of therapeutic for it.
Yeah.
You know, it's really relevant right now. I mean, thinking more of a more mass problem, even getting FDA approval to get a new programmed COVID vaccine, even with this mRNA technology, seems to be a big deal. Is that an FDA problem or is that a technology problem?
I think it's both, but I think it's like a scale distribution and a regulatory issue. But the trials had to be done, and they decided that giving now the, you know, 50% Omicron, 50% original strain vaccine for Moderna is actually yielding a better result. So I think that's going to go out in September, for Moderna's vaccine.
It just feels like we're always playing catch up, right? Yeah. With medicine in general, you know?
Yeah.
I think people are pretty amazed that Operation Warp Speed happened quickly, and in some ways it was 12 years in the making or something.
Yeah.
Do you think that now there's a confluence of things that are happening, whether it's in genomics, you know, or if it's in things like CRISPR, if it's in things, you know, like artificial intelligence that's making this more possible today than it was even 5 years ago?
Yeah, I think AI has a number of roles. And, you know, we should define what is AI, because I think it's such a broad statement in some ways. So I think in the biological context, I mean, you could argue that, even just sequencing a genome at high fidelity and all of this, like, you know, figuring out how they line up and all this stuff, that is a lot of advanced algorithmic stuff that has to go into that human can't just do by looking at the reads coming out of an instrument, right? So it's kind of this confluence of big data in that sense, which has been commoditized when we're dealing with the sequencing, when we're dealing with all this informatics data. And so the way I think of it is that the bioinformatics and the diagnostics are getting commoditized, right? So cheap sequencing exists. Now we have RNA sequencing. So looking at how much of each gene is read out, because it turns out that the gene sequence might not be the most important thing unless something's really wrong. It's how the genes are read that actually determines the cell state in a lot of ways. So that's kind of the whole field of epigenetics and how much RNA for each sequence of DNA you're producing, right? And that field is called transcriptomics. And now we have single cell transcriptomics, where we have enough of the entire human body and understanding what genes are produced and how much of them are produced in each tissue and cell and most of the cell types in physiology and throughout the body. So this is information that's getting really commoditized. But then the biggest question remains, well, what do you do with that information? And for the most part, that information is not, it's not actionable. So you can't actually do anything to get to the cell or tissue that you now know everything about in terms of what's being produced and which markers are on its surface and all of this stuff. I think where AI plays a role for what we're doing is reducing screening times and increasing the predictability of being able to go from the diagnostic information to something that can actually get there. And that's one example of, you know, you have some AI that is basically just glorified spreadsheets, and you have tens of thousands of items in your spreadsheet, and you can visualize it more readily and look at it and understand things or tease out patterns that you wouldn't see by staring at a spreadsheet. Then there's more in this context, AI that is actually helping you design molecules or iterate through those molecules or macromolecules in our case that actually we want to stick to something. Then you could have AI also around like the actual manufacturing. If you're screening a lot of random formulations or a range of things, being able to tease out things within certain ranges. And this is more like spreadsheet stuff in a way, but if you're dealing with 16 or 17 dimensions of data coming out, being able to rapidly identify what works or doesn't is really important. And I think we both do a lot of that sort of work, like with your platform and in our specific screening for our nanomaterials. That's a big part, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I'm jumping around here a bit. You have in some sense, I remember jumping on Clubhouse with you and also, you know, reading tweets and also just hearing about your reputation. I remember there was a time when people considered you paranoid. And so there's this mix of enormous optimism and also fear, I think, of where society is going. I think that you've now been shown to be right about things and not paranoid. You were very concerned about COVID early on. I'm curious where you think the world is headed in the next 5 years. Have we made progress through all of this? Are people thinking differently? I think there's progress in your labs. How do you see this playing out? You know, just in this general psyche of our society and then for the health of our society.
Yeah, I think kind of going back to the beginning of 2020, it was a very strange time to be a biological scientist looking at what was appearing or looking at epidemiology, just looking at you know, numbers, looking at sequences, looking at all this stuff, and here's this virus, and no one thinks it's serious, and it's going to be a cold or whatever. And I think that was like viewing, it was like looking at a train going off the rails and saying, hey, there's a train coming to us. And everyone's like, no, it's okay. It's just a train. It's like, no, it's literally a train coming straight for us. You know, that's crazy. And I'm a lot less worried about, at least in the United States, COVID as of today. But at the same time, I'm much more worried about long COVID. So the people who've already gotten hit the hardest are going to be hit for a long time and are going to struggle with a lot of issues and autoimmunity and all of these issues from having damaged organs of all over. I mean, there are more than 200 symptoms presenting across almost all the major organs.
Are there solutions to that? Are there nanomedicine solutions to being able to look at something like long COVID?
I think that there can be, but it's an extremely tricky thing to look at, because one of the things that is being discovered is that there are autoimmune complications resulting from infection, even in asymptomatic individuals. So there's a study that looked at healthy people who'd not been exposed, asymptomatic, mild, moderate, and severe, and I think critical as well. I need to double check. And they looked at essentially a panel of all of the autoimmune antibodies that were formed in those people against human proteins. So there were a ton against all these cytokines and inflammatory molecules in the blood. Some of them were for major neural proteins. So I think we're going to see a long tail on that. And it's also this chronic fatigue syndrome, like the ME/CFS stuff that a lot of people are getting hit with, or the postural orthostatic, like the POTS, when we basically stand up, your blood pressure goes haywire, your heart starts beating really fast. And this is happening in athletes and whatnot. And that could be affecting, you know, a low double digit percentage of people to some extent in terms of having more than 30 days of symptom presentation. So I think that is really concerning still. And there isn't a simple one-shot solution necessarily. That I would like to think that if you could modulate the immune response to be more specific towards just the antibodies that you want, that maybe those could be potent enough and that some of the others would go more towards your memory immune cells, and that they would just hang out and be quieter. But that's not a guaranteed effect. And we may see just a lot of autoimmune complications. So, but where the world is right now, I think one of the things that concerns me is what you mentioned, the sort of reactive nature of healthcare. And so I think in terms of reactive healthcare, the United States is really on top of its game. In terms of preventative, we are low down the list of developed nations. So we like to treat problems after they happen. And I think that's reflective of how society just acts as a whole in a lot of different ways. Like we are, you know, mostly a nation that is living, you know, check to check, and you go to work and you're, paying your bills, and then you have a certain amount of time every day. So you're playing catch up all the time with all these things. So, and we don't have, a healthcare system that supports really that preventative aspect as much. So that, I don't know that we should talk about why it is that way, if the why is even the important thing, but more so the what can be done and how can we actually change that paradigm. And I think that there is a cost curve associated with diagnostics and the advancement of diagnostics. We need to have much more advanced diagnostics that aren't just taking blood every 6 months from people and saying, here's your cholesterol panel. Having more real-time diagnostics would yield interesting insights for more complex disease states and seeing them. But then you look at companies like Freenome and Grail, even with cancer detection and being able to detect that you have a specific kind of cancer, even before you technically have a cancer, that those sort of technologies, I think emerging over time will be really interesting. And then of course you'll need to go in and be able to do something about it. So can we shift the regulatory framework for drugs and these more advanced therapies to be earlier on? Can we take immunotherapies like CAR T and make them less, noxious and harmful to the person in terms of needing to wipe out your immune system effectively before doing a transplant, can these things become first line? And so I think the sort of vision I would like to see implemented in the next, probably not 5 years, but in terms of beginning the regulatory framework for that, would be more of a personalized medicine approach for understanding, you know, what are all the things that are not quite wrong with you yet, but are going to be probably, and how do we preempt that and create sort of like a personalized journey for that person in terms of all the interventions they're going to need over the next 20 or 30 years. And there are huge cost savings associated with doing that, where you don't have to, you know, spend $2,000 a night on a hospital bed if you don't have to go to hospital to begin with. You don't have to get as many surgeries, perhaps, or you are able to preempt things beforehand. And the cost of the manufacturing, the nanomedicine, is also going to drop a lot for gene therapies as well. Right now, it's expensive because it's mainly been for rare diseases. It has been for rare diseases and for cancer immunotherapies. These are already very expensive things. They were long development cycles that sometimes cost billions of dollars, and the companies need to recoup that, and the insurers are covering these lethal indications or indications that have no standard of care. But once you have the platforms for all of that, I think the cost curve just starts dropping 10x, then 100x, and at some point you're looking at, you know, the $100 gene therapy or something, right? Just like we're approaching $100 genome. At that point, if we understand what's wrong sufficiently well, and this doesn't just apply to gene therapy, it applies to drug delivery, it applies to gene editing, it applies to multiple modalities of transient or more permanent modulation or modification of the disease state. But that's where I think regenerative and personalized medicine starts emerging. And that's what really excites me, more so in a 20-year vision, but we're going to start to see little pieces of that in 5, I think.
Does that go the whole way towards being able to do this work at home yourself and not go to a hospital or not go to a clinic or not even go to a manufacturer? The sort of the 3D printing of medicine for home?
I almost don't want to speculate about it, because even like, you know, doing diagnostics at home is so hard, aside from like a COVID test or whatnot. So it's going to be a huge regulatory thing. Can it be done?
Yeah, let's forget regulatory exists, and let's pretend we live in a world where we don't have to deal with that.
Oh, then absolutely. I think everyone would have like a little mini factory that just you're always sequencing things. You're, you know, maybe taking some blood here and there or whatnot. Or, you know, spitting in vials as we do for sequencing already. And you're getting the data back so fast, and you're getting this continuous sort of monitoring whenever you want of how things are going, to the extent that you can gather that from non-invasive tests. And then, you know, it shouldn't be that hard to manufacture things on demand, on the spot. I think you could probably, you know, have a box about this big that just makes different things. I think it's definitely something that I remember years ago talking about. Can you get something, you know, the size of a laptop that could just make these different things?
Yeah.
And I think it's definitely possible. Right?
It makes you, it makes you want to, the regulatory issues are so big that even you laughed about the idea of doing this when this has got to be the big dream, right? It makes it seem like not so crazy when people talk about, you know, some type of, you know, libertarian free zone in the middle of the ocean, you know, or, you know, doing, you know, creating new rules when you go to Mars or something in order to start fresh. And I find that really sad, but also technologically really exciting.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that it doesn't take something like how COVID had to happen for us to see mRNA vaccines, that it doesn't take some other catastrophe for people to realize that it might be good to be able to treat yourself at home with a thing the size of a box, and, you know, do sequences when you want, and do, you know, create new molecules, new peptides, new all these things yourself. And, you know, that's the big hope. I don't watch, you know, Star Trek and think that that's impossible to do these things, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I could envision having something that has sufficiently advanced biometrics and also controlled doses and can't be tampered with. I mean, you would need a lot to do that in a regulatory framework, but it's not impossible to imagine that you could have kind of almost like software updates for the thing that you want to manufacture, which I think, you know, I don't want to talk about like necessarily our work stuff so much, but that is...
No, please, go ahead. I'd love to hear about it.
Yeah, like building these, you know, between the two of us, like building these modular manufacturing capabilities and then being able to provide that. I mean, initially it'll be like larger companies and things like that, but providing updates to them for the things being manufactured and just can point and click and make the drug or the gene therapy you want, right? At some point that all gets miniaturized and it's really just a regulatory question
the regulatory thing is gets to be such a frustrating, boring conversation in some ways, but it's where our lives always end up in landing. But I think, you know, having talked about, you know, a little bit of this so far, I think we'd love to hear, I'd certainly love to hear more about Ligandol and where it plays in this, because hopefully the hope comes with what people are actually doing, not just dreaming. As all I do is sit there and hope that a future like this happens. You're actually working
on it. I'm not sure that's the case.
Talk about that a little.
Very, very humble here.
Tell us about it.
Yeah. You know, basically,
by the way, you started this company when you were 22 years old. Is that right?
Yeah.
I won't even talk about, you know, I was like playing the piano and, you know, hanging out in New York, and you're starting a world changing company at that age.
Yeah. So I suppose that vision of the targeting being enabled is so critical, and that's one of the things that we work on, and that's why we called the company Ligandol, because we make ligands that are molecules. Ligand is a molecule that sticks to some other molecule. It's a very generic concept, but we are figuring out how to build those ligands and those molecules that bind to specific markers on specific cells and can be used for delivery. And essentially now we have these technologies like Moderna's and Pfizer's and the aforementioned gene therapy technologies that are all of these really advanced tools to be able to modulate disease states that can't get to the right tissues for the most part. And so expanding the capability to target those tissues is really a gating factor, sort of a last mile problem towards enabling personalized medicine and really what I like to call diagnostically responsive medicine, in that the medicine itself is evolving and changing in response to diagnosis. Whereas personalized medicine could mean I'm just matching drugs to your diagnosis that already exists. And so kind of coining that term of like diagnostically responsive medicine is a subset of personalized medicine, where the medicine itself evolves and is completely engineered to the specific disease state, is something that I'm really excited about personally, that I think we're on the path to being able to do if we succeed in our mission of essentially starting off in these rare diseases, starting off in these immuno-oncology applications and in specialized applications, but sort of building out within that map of the things we want to target, the shipping routes. And once we have the shipping routes, then it's much easier to deliver multiple packages, whether they be CRISPR or mRNA or proteins or next generation editors or logic gated gene switches or whatever you can envision. Essentially, the entire toolbox of human creativity and inventiveness around all of these next generation tools and gene regulatory and editing approaches, being able to shuttle them to the place where they need to be. And that's sort of the 20-year vision, is that by enabling all these things, it becomes possible to really rapidly go after not just diseases, but even prophylactically treating things. And that's personally the world I want to live in. Like worthwhile problem to be willing to spend my, you know, adult life on.
Yeah. How far, I hear your 20-year vision. How far are you away from us all seeing something that will, you know, be a step towards the world that we want to see?
Yeah. So we're initiating now a collaboration. I can't talk about all the details around, but it is one example of sort of a commercial application of what we've been working on for a long time. And I see this and multiple other, not just internal development, but the partnering activities that we're engaged in as being stepping stones towards that. And one of the things is also that we're taking on a bit of a distributed risk approach. So in terms of how long, I would say in the next 2 to 3 years, I would really like to see us have IND enabling data for at least one rare disease. And realistically, it would be 2 or 3 rare diseases probably, because they're going to be affecting the same cell or tissue. And we've been focusing a lot on hematology because it's a mature market in terms of the cell therapy space. And there are still a lot of improvements that need to be done in the cell therapy space. But also we want to sort of usher in the next generation of not needing to take cells out of the body. And so it's really about generating those data sets and then also having the partners generate those data sets. And hopefully we get to go after 2 or 3 organ systems through the partnering activities and focus in on essentially one major set of applications internally.
It's always, I find it's always interesting whether to be, you know, we talked about being reactive as a country and not proactive. But as a scientist or even a entrepreneur, you know, that has a business, when to follow what the market is asking for and when to do something that you feel is the next right step. How do you balance those two things?
You know,
or are they the same?
I really want to ask you the same question too.
Sure.
Because I think there's a, you know, if you're a little bit too idealistic, then you run into the sort of, well, given sufficient time and money and resources and all this, then you would do X, Y, Z, right? And then you have to compromise with, well, what can you do right now? What can you do tomorrow? What can you do a month from now? What can you do 6 months from now? What do you think you can accomplish in this period of time? And as kind of the old adage goes, that you know, you overestimate what you'll do in a year, but you'll underestimate what you'll do in 10. And balancing that, I think, depends on the technology. It depends on the approach. It depends on how passionate you are about it. It depends on how realistic it is. And it depends on how broad the application sets are in terms of their impact on humanity and others. So if it's a single product play, or, you know, here is X, I'm building for Y, and I'm going to sell it and then I'm done, then, you know, you can kind of do that calculation in your head relative to your ethos, your morals, your vision, your idea of what succeeding at that thing means, and kind of parse it out. And maybe you sell it and you're done, or you just have it running and it's on autopilot or whatnot. But I think it's extremely hard. That's an extremely hard question to answer when you say, okay, I want to like solve all these things, and you have to start somewhere. And when you start somewhere, you then need to focus on that thing, and it requires a certain amount of resources to get from A to B to C to D. So that's been, I think, the hardest thing in some ways is finding that balance, even when you know exactly what you're focusing on, but then having these capabilities emerge that you could do these other things, and then you want to focus but not spread yourself too thin. I mean, how do you manage having how many partnerships?
There's so many ups and downs there, and there are many factors that affect this. There is a real, I don't know, funder or you know, VC idea that you should be hyper focused, and I get that. I mean, one of our big investors is really good at saying how you sort of monopolize a small market and then grow from there and do it with a larger market. And I get this idea, but it can, there have been mornings that I've gotten up and I've said, I don't know you know, is this really what, why am I doing this with my life? You know, I left academia in order to start a company so that I could have a more rapid impact. And then, you know, if I'm just focusing on these one things and I find something else exciting and partnerships that are potentially exciting, why can't I go after that? There's a couple of things that we do about it that have given me enormous hope and why I'm in a really exciting place. A big one is forming, you know, very close relationships with your customers, and, you know, hoping that in some ways you can inspire them and they can inspire you, and it leads to a product that is different than either of you would imagine. Well, where that fails, partnering with others who, you know, that have a very close vision already, is harder to find. I think we found it with you, for instance. And that becomes good. But I've now come to see taking as much into our own hands as possible and kind of ignoring this anything that is considered common wisdom about how you further technology. And one reason is we see, as you said, how things have failed in the past, not just for our company, but just in general. So, you know, why stick with something that's common? Go ahead and spread yourself too thin if need be, if you know, you can start to create it yourself rather than wait for others to. Waiting can be the most depressing part of it, I think. And some of that, I think another way that you handle this is you have, you know, the unfortunate just, you know, financial nature of how things go about. You raise a lot of money, you try to figure out how to afford doing what you would like to do, you prove it to the market, and then, you know, and then that allows your business to continue. So it's balancing all those things, you know, they're good days and bad days, you know, and all in the same week. And maybe there's good hours and bad hours throughout a week, but it's a challenge, but exciting times. And I think that I certainly see it with you. And, you know, I see that a lot of our conversations look like we're reacting to something going on in the news. And, you know, that seems to some people like it's changing focus, but it's the same technologies that you've been working on for many years.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that thing happens to now have become relevant in a new way. And, you know, showing people that, you know, the whole point of nanotechnology is that it's transferable in this way.
Yeah.
So, you know, I there's a big communication aspect to all of this, right? So that people realize that it's actually hyper-focused to be dealing with a lot of different things at once. That seems like a paradox, but it really isn't when you're talking about this type of work.
Yeah. Wow, that's well put. I feel that. I mean, a couple examples even. When COVID hit and I got access to the sequences first, you know, that was a 5-hour start to finish process to design a set of peptides that mimicked it. But it took almost 9 years of learning how to do this to be able to do that in 5 hours. Then looking
at... But now you can do a lot in 5 hours, right?
Yeah,
exactly. The 9 years paid off.
There's a focus, there's a resource aspect, but... That's interesting, right? And that's one of the reasons that I want to build these broader capabilities to just be able to do these things fast and distributed, because I think pharma and biotech have been so vertically integrated, and there are a lot of reasons for that. Small molecule discovery, typical development cycles, you know, how costly it is, all this stuff. There are very good reasons that it's been focused and vertically integrated. But when you start looking at the next generation of technologies, they don't necessarily have to be as vertically integrated. The funding models where you put $100 million into a company to start it. I've talked to so many C-level executives and first employees and whatnot at these major companies in the platform, you know, space around gene therapies and whatever. And pretty much the thing that's reflected back is, several things are reflected back. One is, you know, you get all that money and then you're under the gun, you're on the clock. Go get to clinic as quickly as possible. Don't do startup squared where you're taking multiple risks. If you're taking one technical risk, don't take another technical risk. If you're taking a technical risk, don't take a business risk. If you're taking a business risk, don't take any technical risk. And all of these sort of old, like, you know, business philosophies come into play. So everyone says, okay, so we've got CRISPR. Okay, what are we doing? Well, let's not reinvent the delivery systems. then, you know, let's not reinvent the diseases we're going after. Well, let's not take risks there. So everyone goes after, you know, liver diseases first, because that's the easiest thing to target. And you just see then, well, okay, what else are we doing? Well, we better do cell therapies. Okay, we're going to engineer cells in a dish. That's safe. But then, okay, maybe eye diseases. That's good. Yeah, we could use a virus for that if we wanted to. And there's no immune response, and it's immune privileged tissue. So yeah, that's great. And so everyone just goes kind of, for the most part, after these things. Not to say that there isn't great innovation happening in different fields. It just is sort of disjointed. And then you're on, you know, you're under the gun, 2 o'clock, go get to clinic, go get into your phase ones. And then kind of the next piece of traditional wisdom received is, I'll almost quote, once you're in the clinic, it's not like you're doing any R&D anyway. So then once you're in the clinic, you're not doing your R&D, you're pushing forward the clinical programs, and you got to figure out scale up, distribution, you know, regulatory, are you pharma partnering? Are you a pharma company yourself? All this stuff. So that it's basically like there's the biotech valley of death, and then innovation goes to die once it's emanated or acquired. And I really think that there's a better way to do things, because the pharma companies want the assets, they want the drugs, they want the gene therapies, they want, you know, XYZ, ABC diseases. And they should be able to have those things because they're good at distribution and regulatory and all the scale and all of that. But why is everyone, or why is the traditional model just IPO or M&A? And Moderna tried to do this out the gate. They started many subsidiaries, but they raised so much money and then partnered off those subsidiaries, and the COVID programs ended up being the lead. I think there's a better way to do it. I just think it hasn't quite been done yet in the industry.
Yeah, I find it interesting that, you know, you talk about whether it's CRISPR or whether it's, you know, any of the stuff that we've been speaking about until this last moment about the way that the industry generally works, is that there are now platforms, you know, CRISPR can be used for many different things, but yet the process is still this linear binary process of you create a therapy and it passes or fails. It's one reason why I don't like to, when I mention Ligandol, I don't like to say it's a biotech company, even though in a way it is, but because immediately the assumption is that a biotech company is going to go through this exact process of finding a particular therapeutic, going through a 10-year, billion-dollar a process of getting it approved, and it may or may not work. It's really hard to break that mentality and say, this is not the way the world is going to work. It's not the way the world is already starting to work. I have great hopes that people start to understand where medicine has come, or where, I wouldn't even say it's medicine, where technology has come, so that we don't have to think of medicine as medicine in the same way, whether it's doing preventative stuff or just being able to react so quickly the way that you are talking about being able to react quickly. You know, I like to talk about the more exciting utopian ideas that we have, but I'm going to bring up something more depressing, but hopefully there's some upside to it. It's biodefense. And, you know, I think that's another area you focused on. And I guess that being able to react quickly for a pandemic, or being able to react for a bio attack, or being able to prevent one, has some similarities. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. I was talking to another entrepreneur who's more in the cybersecurity space, and we had this conversation about cybersecurity and defense of cybersecurity attacks versus biosecurity and biodefense, right? And he pointed something out in terms of how he described it, which I thought is a really good summary, that when you deal with cybersecurity, offense is much more expensive than defense. You know, if you have state level resources, you can maybe crack through, but it's expensive and it's hard. With biodefense, it's the opposite. It's very cheap and easy to build something that can break down the defenses, because we effectively have no defenses. We only have reactions to things after they come about. We don't have like a preemptive firewall, right? And so that's something I'm really interested in seeing and building. And I don't think we get there just with vaccine technologies and by making drugs to treat viruses in the traditional sense. So then there are a lot of implications there, one of which is that right now there's so much gain of function research happening globally. And I think if you look at, you know, sort of the superpowers or even just countries in general, there's always been some sort of arms race in place, and that's still going on. And it's happening now in a biological context, except for we're stockpiling all of this biological and chemical warfare technology and agents, you know, in biosafety labs, biosafety level 3 or 4 labs, which, as we've seen, can sometimes not be so secure. And so I think that's something where I would really like to see the resources that are going into gain of function research be redirected into seeing whether we can create, you know, few day turnaround time to the mitigation aspect of if something were to break out, so that the plan doesn't even have to become, oh my gosh, we need to go vaccinate a billion people and update our vaccines every time something happens, as we're starting to see now with monkeypox, perhaps.
Yeah, I think about this. It's hard to think of an equivalent of mutually assured destruction for biowarfare. And yet we have a type of mentality this way. I think the gain of function research feels like that to me. You know, even if it's not being used for biosecurity in exactly that way, or maybe it's not said to be used in exactly that way, it feels like a lost cause to me to try to have a mutually assured destruction way of dealing with bio safety. Do you think that's true?
I mean, I think it's reckless and it's stupid.
Yeah. Yet it's happening, right?
Yeah. I mean, just going off public information, for instance, so I won't go on the air and make the claim that, you know, the virus that causes COVID was bioengineered. I won't.
But we can imagine,
more than likely in my assessment, and more recently also the State Department's assessment, the lab leak is the least investigated and the most likely explanation. Right now, we can skip over the COVID origins thing. I think everyone knows where I stand on where that is most likely the case, but where you go back a few years to some of these studies that were being done, they were going to bat caves. Like EcoHealth Alliance was going to bat caves. You know, this was a multi-country collaboration. And they were collecting new SARS-related coronaviruses from bats, and they identified 3 that had higher binding to human ACE2 receptors. And then they did recombination experiments, taking these higher binding ACE2 receptor binding spike proteins and sticking them onto different viral scaffolds. And you could say publicly that you only did that with like pseudoviruses, but they did it on SARS backbones and other backbones as well. And then you're working in, you know, hamsters and humanized ACE2 mice that have the human ACE2 receptors. So you're basically doing transmissibility and transmission studies. So I'm glad we understand that you can increase transmissibility by increasing the binding to like a human receptor for a virus, or, you know, like comparing SARS-1 to SARS-2, it's about 10 times more strongly binding to the ACE2 receptor, even though it's less lethal. But like, there's all this stuff that, if you actually take that same knowledge that goes into understanding, or dare I say, engineering increased transmissibility or lethality of a pathogen, you could be directing those resources into, I really liked our approach in terms of taking the virus and copy pasting the part that sticks to the cell and printing it out fast, because this can serve a dual function as a therapeutic and a prophylactic and even a vaccine. technology, but then you have even like antibodies and being able to create antibodies against a specific virus. We can do that very quickly. So the question is, can we just get to the point that the testing is so good that we can test for new viruses as they come out and do so en masse and essentially have hotspots where you could administer early treatments and prophylactics? I think if you're dealing with a sufficiently dangerous pathogen, you will have to lock down an area. And I think that the federal government should intercede in locking down things and being able to do that. I don't think you can leave that to states and to local jurisdictions to just do what they will. If you're dealing with something that, you know, let's say we had like something like a smallpox that's 10% lethal and transmits, like you can't just say, okay, let's argue about whether we should wear a mask or not. I think we can at this stage argue about whether or not we should wear masks with COVID. I think that's a legitimate argument. I don't think it was a legitimate argument in April of 2020. I think I don't care what your political view is. Like if you have, you know, if you're going to see someone who's 65 and up and you're creating a potential 20% probability for them to die, then that's reckless endangerment and you should wear, you know, a mask. Like, but at this stage in the pandemic and after exposure and a million people have died, we can have that conversation. I don't think people should be forced to wear masks, but imagine something that's 10 times more lethal than COVID. Imagine something that leaves scarring on your body, like monkeypox. People will notice that. They won't notice the scars in their lungs and the damage inside their body. But if, you know, you start having...
A million people have died in the United States. It's incredible. And yeah, we have these long COVID effects that I think a lot of us will have, even if we don't know exactly what they are yet. Yeah. And you know, a lot of this political discussion was did we overreact early on? And it seems like, wow, overreact, you know, how could you overreact? And we have a million people dead, right? This seems like an underreaction in so many ways. And now probably thinking ahead, it's an underreaction to not think that we're going to get into a similar situation, whether it was from gain of function research or accidentally or, you know, straight up bioterrorism. It really concerns me. Is that one of the things that concerns you the most?
Yeah, that's one of the things that keeps me up sometimes. Even now looking at monkeypox and the case doubling rate and the prevalence of testing, the way it's being framed is only a disease that primarily affects people who are homosexual, bisexual, or right? And then we're once again not going to really talk about respiratory transmission. We're going to brand it as something that, you know, spreads in gay saunas.
Yeah,
it's not.
It's great that we have such long memories.
Yeah, and then and I don't think that monkeypox is going to be as I don't want to say actually what I do or don't think. I think it's of concern. I think it's of more concern than probably on average person is concerned. It's less concern than, you know, if we had smallpox come back or something like that.
Yeah.
I think we do need to have much better testing for viruses in general. I mean, I would really love for, maybe this is almost like a side note or a tangent, but I would love to be able to have some sort of whole virome screening happening for people, right? Like,
cool.
Why can't you get tested for more viruses more readily?
This sounds like an interesting startup idea, don't you think?
It would be a really interesting startup. Honestly, if someone made like a lateral flow strip for like 10 or 20 viruses, that would be such a great idea.
Yeah, maybe, that's a good idea. Maybe somebody listening.
I don't know. Should we include the podcast? Should we do it, Matthew?
Yeah, right. Well, that's the thing. Are we about to spread ourselves too thin and just take on something else again and try to discourage our investors one more time?
We need a Skunk Works, man. We need a Skunk Works and just like a fat bag of cash to put into the Skunk Works.
I like that idea. I like that idea a lot.
Don't talk to anyone for like 3 years. Like, what are you doing? Can't talk about it. Sorry, can't talk about it.
Yeah, saving the world from saving the world. And that's all we have to say.
It's like, why didn't you tell us? We would have loved to invest in it. It's like, yeah, no, you wouldn't have.
No, you wouldn't have. We know you guys. You say it now.
I'll send you a free sample.
Well, you know, this is a sort of weird philosophical way to maybe wrap up things. And if it's stupid, we'll wrap it up in a different way. The author Julian Barnes wrote a book, I think it was called Nothing to Fear. Do you know about this book?
Mm-hmm.
It's basically about his existential crisis, about thinking about death and how it is actually terrifying. And so it's like nothing to fear. And he makes a point that people he feels are either scared of suffering and death, or suffering and dying, or they're scared of death. And I always thought and that those things are mutually exclusive. And I found that really a fascinating thing. I read that years ago. And I'm not going to necessarily ask whether how scared of death you are or how scared of dying. But when I think about the goal of work that you're doing or things that you're concerned about, talking about, you know, more immediate plans versus longevity and, you know, ending, you know, or extending life, those things do come to my mind. Can you speak a little to which of those you think that something either you personally or like Anatol or is more focused on or cares more about?
Yeah, I want to answer the philosophical question. When I think about it, I don't fear death. I don't fear nothingness. I think, we come from sort of a nothingness and go into nothingness, and even the universe, at some point experiences heat death, and it's all just different scales of different things. Would it be nice to have a little bit of choice in how long, you can be healthy for, or how long you can be around? I think that'd be great. Mainly because there's kind of this push to, you know, have a career, then typically, right, it's like a career, you know, get a house or go to college, have a career, get a house, have a family, retire, and then you die, more or less. And that arc could have multiple careers or cycles if you could add, let's say, 20 years of healthy lifespan, right? You could have another career. You could go do something completely different. You could raise a family and then still be maybe young enough that you're like, cool, I'm going to spend like maybe the next 20 years on something else. And you're still retaining that knowledge and what you've learned. And if you're living that much longer and you're healthy, not like old age living longer, then, you know, your memory is probably better. You have more energy, all of this stuff. So I think that is something that motivates me, because I think the greatest sort of healthcare or the greatest health burden comes about from just the aging process in general. If you can reduce also the suffering around that, that's great. So I guess I fear more the pain and the suffering of like that slow, drawn out process than the idea of death itself. I find the idea of nothingness to not be anxiety inducing at all. What about you?
Interesting. I'm actually more scared of death, but I don't think that's rational. It's just the interesting thing though is that this while those two feelings may be slightly mutually exclusive, the way Julian Barnes said, the solutions may not be. You know, the work that you're doing may help extend life, I would say, you know, a reduction of death. As you said, you have heat death of the universe. It's not a feasible thing, but at least extend life enough to get over the fear of death, maybe. But, you know, so these things both could work in concert together. So there's not, but yeah, I personally happen to be, a bit existentially in dread, for no rational reason. You know, there was a time I wasn't here on the planet and I was fine not being here. But yeah. All right, Andre, I do think you're doing just such important work, and I think you're an amazing guy and friend. And, you know, I enjoy everything from these types of discussions to playing music with you, which is another passion that we share. You know, much more to come. I thank you so much for spending your time with me today doing
this. Thank you. Thank you, too. I'm looking forward to many more.